This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. And as we wrap up 2018, there were some big stories in education that had an impact nationally and locally. The mass shooting in Parkland this past February sent the nation into fear and mourning. But it also inspired students across the country to rise up, speak out, and plan school walkouts. Hurricane Florence was also big news this year. We'll look at the way educators and students are still trying to recover. And a story that carried over from 2017 is what to do with Silent Sam. Joining us now to go over the biggest stories in education are two of our own reporters who focus on education, Liz Schlimmer and Lisa Phillip. Welcome to the State of Things to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Rick.
Hi, thanks.
Lisa, let me start with you. Last week, the UNC Board of Governors rejected the UNC Chapel Hill Board of Trustees' plan to build a $5.3 million historic center to house Silent Sam. So now there's a new committee, and they've got a deadline, March 15th. Remind us what's happening there, and you know who is this body now that will make this decision?
Yeah, so last week, of course, the Board of Governors came out against the plan. The public reason given was cost, but it's hard to know what individual reasoning was because all of this, the discussion, which lasted 3 hours and may have involved some other things, but all of that was behind closed doors, and there was no public debate before members voted. So all we know is that they have this new plan to put to work a committee of Board of Governors members to work with UNC Chapel Hill officials to come up with a new plan by March 15th. So this is getting pushed forward even further. But so the members that will be serving are Daryl Allison, Jim Holmes, Wendy Murphy, Anna Nelson, and Bob Ruccio. And so we have some very, very different personalities in that group of members. Daryl Allison is the only Black member in this small group. There aren't many Black members on the Board of Governors overall. He's known as a very big charter school advocate, but he also notably, when the board was making their decision about the Civil Rights Center at UNC and whether they would be allowed to engage in litigation, he abstained from voting and didn't really take a stand publicly in that issue. And then we also have Bob Ruccio, who is a former state legislator who has a rather fiery personality and is known for making just these very strong comments occasionally. Recently when the board was voting on chancellor raises, he came out and said he wasn't voting for it because someone, and he never named this person, had acted unprofessionally. And when reporters approached him, he wouldn't say who it was or what the reasoning was. And then another notable person is Anna Nelson, who tends to be a moderating voice. Her father was, of course, the well-regarded former president of the UNC system, C.D. Spangler. And she, in the Civil Rights Center vote, was one of three members who voted against banning litigation there. So we have a very interesting collection of perspectives, and it will be fascinating
and
to see what
they
come
up. And they face the same problem the Board of Trustees did, which is that whatever they say, a lot of people are going to be unhappy. And now it's been pushed back to March 15th. So we will stay tuned.
Yes, exactly.
Silent Sam, a national story. USA Today continues to follow it. Another big story, of course, this year was the mass shooting at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. 17 people were killed in what's been called the worst school shooting since Columbine. Parkland resonates with students across the nation and certainly across the state. Liz, talk about the statewide school protests and walkouts that you covered.
Well, there were a number of events, vigils, walkouts, protests. First, immediately after the Parkland shooting, we saw vigils in Raleigh, brought out a large number of students and educators, and then planned walkouts with the National March for Our Lives movement, and again in commemoration of the shooting at Columbine. And I don't know that I would quite say that they were statewide protests, though. They happened in a number of especially urban districts. You know, I called up some rural districts that day where they said, well, we had maybe a dozen students walk out. It wasn't as organized. And then we know in Wilson, North Carolina, there was one student, Justin Blackman, who made national news for being the only student who walked out at his school. But these, you know, they were moving. The vigils especially were sad moments when they were thinking about these 17 students, very much like them, very much like high schoolers across the country, who lost their lives to gun violence.
Well, what stood out for you? Because not only were these students mourning the loss of students in their cohort, people who they could more closely identify with others, but it was also, in many cases, a call for action, right?
It was. I mean, these students are asking for gun control. They're asking for the debate to be about guns in addition to being about school safety generally. But what really struck me talking to these students was the genuine fear that they have. And I think that's generational, too. If you talk to baby boomers, it's a pretty foreign concept to them to have school shootings. And I think Gen Xers and millennials, you know, we saw Columbine or the Virginia Tech shooting, but they seem more like isolated incidents. And now when you talk to especially high schoolers, they feel like this is happening with such frequency, these school shootings, that they have a sense that it could really happen to them.
And there was action taken, of course, nationally. Lisa, one of the answers to school shootings and safety is the push for more resource officers. But then you did some reporting that suggests that this could cause more harm than good, particularly when it comes to minority students, right?
Yeah. So we saw after this push for more school resource officers that students of color and educators of color were coming out against such plans because I talked to a law professor in Florida who studied the impact of school resource officers, and he found that the more resource officers you had in school, the more school-based arrests you have. So these are situations where maybe kids were fighting or talking back to a teacher, even some rather subjective offenses. Instead of those being handled by school administrators, they're being passed off to police officers in schools because they're there, they're an extra resource, administrators are busy, et cetera. And then if we look at the numbers in terms of kids who are arrested at school, they are disproportionately Black students, both Black boys and Black girls. So, of course, there's that concern that the more resource officers you put into schools, the more negative effect they're going to have on students of color in particular.
And the correlation between even suspensions and contact with the criminal justice system is very, very high. And so if you have a disproportionate number of minority students who are then pushed into that system, that's where we find this basically defines the school to prison pipeline.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, a suspension or an arrest can have very long-term impacts on a kid's self-esteem, on the fact that they may have a criminal record going out of this, and this can affect their chances at higher education and employment later. So these are like, you know, high school kids, they're kids, and they potentially have these impacts that reach far into their adult lives.
The other big story this year, of course, the Hurricane Florence. Lots of focus on storm damage, FEMA deadlines, rebuilding, and the two of you focused on the impact the storm had on schools. Lisa, let me stay with you. Talk about the impact there.
Yeah, so Liz and I both connected with schools in Wilmington in particular to see how they were dealing with the storm.
Right.
In Wilmington, kids were out of school for about 3 or 4 weeks. And what we saw there is, you know, these kids weren't necessarily just going back to schools that may have been damaged. They may have lost homes themselves. They maybe were in Wilmington when the storm rolled through. And that kind of experience can have very serious impact on both just their emotional well-being and their learning when they get back to school. And I connected with a teacher who had lost her home, and she herself has a small child, a 2 or 3 year old, and so she was dealing with all of this while also preparing to welcome back her students and try to support them through this event. So you can imagine just the emotional toll that this kind of thing takes on kids, not to mention the financial impact.
Well, emotionally very trying, and of course this comes on the heels of Matthew, which so it's a double whammy within just 2 years. And Liz, there is the brick and mortar financial damage, and you looked at some of what these schools, many of them in rural districts, without the wherewithal sometimes to just make budget year to year, and then this. Tell us about the financial impact.
So the state does insure many of those coastal schools, and the State Board of Education gets updates from the Education Insurance Fund on those claims. Originally, it was estimated around $40 million. That's gone up to $55 million in claims from schools and community colleges in the area. The school that I visited when we were doing these stories saw direct flooding as well as mold in some of the walls. Many of these schools had roof damage. I'm told all the roofs are repaired now, but still $55 million in brick and mortar losses. And also the losses that, you know, Lisa was talking about, that students lost supplies, classrooms lost supplies, and there's now a fund, the NC FAST Fund, that is trying to give grants to schools, but, you know, some of those losses may not be recovered.
And the legislature and governor have addressed some of this by certainly with funding, but also more flexibility in terms of how they make it up. Tell us a little bit about what the legislature has done, public policymakers.
So they've allowed schools to make their own decision about how many days they're going to make up to 20 days. So the state will forgive up to 20 of missed days. And there were a number of counties that missed close to 20 days and more than 20 days of school. So they may have to make up some of those. But then there's also concern about what happens when students miss that many days. If they don't have to make up those 20 days, are we going to see effects later as they move on to upper grades or when they hit testing in the spring?
WUNC education reporters Liz Schlemmer and Lisa Phillip, thanks so much for your reporting all year and this summary today. And by the way, you can find links to their reporting at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Frank.
Thanks.
Just ahead, we will learn why you need to be careful when you clean your house. You might be doing too much. Find out why on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned.